and somber English persons with a remarkably frigid shore, though history tends to treat it this way. It was, in its general outlines, an old presence in English life, long suppressed, briefly dominant, then suppressed again. Under Queen Mary, particularly, dissenters had fled to Europe, where there were cities in Germany, France, the Low Countries, Switzerland, Bohemia, and elsewhere, which had already organized themselves in accordance with Reformed social thought and which Reformed English saw as models. Puritanism is an English name for the local expression of a movement that was in fact actively international. The term has been effective in creating the impression that people to whom it was applied were narrow, eccentric, and naive, though they printed and translated each other's books, studied and taught in each other's universities, afforded each other shelter in times of persecution, and fought in each other's wars, as many English did on behalf of the Dutch Republic. Colonial Puritans traveled to Britain and involved themselves deeply in British affairs, including the civil wars and the Commonwealth government. The English Puritans were so prone to writing and printing that there is no special difficulty in reconstructing their forgotten history, once one is aware of their forgotten literature. One vast work, highly popular in England and America, is sufficient by itself to demonstrate their understanding of themselves and their origins. This is The Acts and Monuments of the Martyrs by John Fox, which covers in truly incredible detail the history of the Church, in his view, the true Church, from its earliest origins in the beginning of the Christian era to the time in which he wrote. The true and primitive Church, for him, is the dissenting tradition. This might seem a naive undertaking, but Fox's book is in fact heavily documented with early treatises in Greek and Latin and their translations, letters to and from popes, disputations on theological subjects which are long dialogues in Latin and then English. Golding, in translating Calvin, uses the word historiography, which otherwise I might have considered an anachronism in this context. Fox's work, which grew to 3 huge volumes, is by far the most sophisticated historiography I have encountered. Ever, I suppose. Obviously, it is not without bias. Nothing of the kind could be. I am in no position to authenticate the hundreds of documents the volumes contain, though I have seen nothing, in the letters of Mary Tudor to her half-brother Edward VI, for example, that is at odds with what I have seen elsewhere. The theological disputations stand on their own, without tendentious interpretations. There is careful attention to the reigns of kings, including those who figure in Shakespeare's plays. The chronicle histories draw on Fox. Where in the world all this material could have come from, I have no idea. The books were printed meticulously by John Day, an important publisher of dissenting works. They are illustrated with engravings famous for their depictions of martyrdoms, and more appropriately famous for their quality. I have read that Fox's adherence to the truth has been questioned in some particulars. Clearly, I am the last person in the world to believe in the infallibility of any history. But, granting that there surely are errors in such an enormous work, not to mention questionable assumptions and interpretations, and that it was produced to champion one side in a passionate debate, it can nevertheless tell us a great deal about who the Puritans believed they were and about the legacy they embraced. Puritans felt they were in a line of descent of defenders of an original Christianity, by which they meant those who lived before or rejected what they took to be historical accretions. The papacy, the sacrifice of the Mass, transubstantiation and communion in one kind, priestly celibacy and celibacy of women religious, auricular confession, purgatory and prayers for the dead, pilgrimages and crusades, and the use of icons among them. From what we can know about earlier suppressed movements in England, in all these things they did anticipate the Reformation. Over years and generations, there was a furtive traffic in forbidden texts that is demonstrated by the punishments of those found in possession of them. I will argue that Puritanism in Anglo-American tradition took a distinctive character from a particular constellation of events of the 14th century. The brief flourishing of a high literature in English, the Black Death, Wycliffe's career as a professor at Oxford, the translation by him or under his influence of the whole Bible from Latin into English, and the rise of Lollardy. I know I am entering contested territory here. It is usual to say that English Protestants retrojected Protestantism onto this moment opportunistically. Protestantism is an inexact word here. Puritanism would be much better. In any case, ideas have origins, and influences are real and constitute a lineage of true legitimacy and importance. Historical figures are historical because they set in motion change they themselves could not anticipate and might not endorse in every particular. These writers, whom it is supposedly wrong to regard as proto-Puritan, articulated ideas that could only have shaped Puritanism in the very fact of their appropriation, even if it was granted that there is no more direct relationship among them. I will note here that stigma is again a factor in all this. Lollard is usually said to refer to slurred speech, associating this movement with the lower classes. According to the Oxford English Dictionary, its first meaning is a name of contempt given in the 14th century to certain heretics who were either followers of Wycliffe or held opinions similar to his. A great part of the work of bad history is done by these terms of contempt. In light of this scorn, it might seem odd that the Puritans' claim to this heretical movement should be rejected. But, as it happened, the first great period in English literature was somehow associated with it. Geoffrey Chaucer was, like Wycliffe, a friend of John of Gaunt, uncle to King Richard II. William Langland may have been a Lollard himself. John Gower, a friend of Chaucer, was active at the time, writing his odd didactic poetry. Wycliffe is ranked among these great early writers in English for his prose, so there is enormous prestige attached to it all, however uneasily. An interesting and remarkable thing about Lollardy or Wycliffism is that the movement had impeccable intellectual origins and, in its early phase, attracted the support of people of rank. This is true at the same time that it was essentially a movement meant to liberate and elevate the impoverished and oppressed by giving them a Bible in their own language, as well as sending out poor priests to instruct them in understanding it. Wycliffe was a man of good family, a scholar, philosopher, and preacher of very high standing, known and admired by the powerful figures of the period, enjoying the loyalty of his colleagues. According to the article about him in the 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, the essence of his teaching was the immediate dependence of the individual Christian upon God, a relation which needs no mediation of any priest, and to which the very sacraments of the church, however desirable, are not essentially necessary. He divorces the idea of the church from any connection with its official or formal constitution, and conceives it as consisting exclusively of the righteous. Radical as all this was at the time, Wycliffe is most remarkable for his having sponsored, at least, the creation of his Bible in English, its first version completed in 1382. To that time, of course, Latin and French were the languages of the upper classes, universities, government, and church. Sigmund Freud called Americans Lollards, intending no compliment. Still, he might have had a point. There was in New England a virtual aristocracy of learning, and at the same time, a commitment to making learning general that structured their institutions, churches, schools, and press. This looks more like Lollardy than like other social orders of its time. By comparison, neither public education nor printing were characteristic of the Anglican South in the colonial period or after it. The high populism of the Wycliffeites, who, after 1400, were burned for their efforts, their writings burned as well, put knowledge and therefore autonomy of a kind into the hands of ordinary people, the peasant, the plowman. In 1348, the Black Death had struck England, diminishing the population of laborers so abruptly and severely that those who remained were able to negotiate for better wages or to travel to find better employment. Their standard of living rose. Landowners took harsh steps to reverse these gains, and finally, in 1381, a powerful insurrection broke out called the Peasants' Revolt. Wycliffe and his teachings were blamed for this uprising. That he did inspire it in some degree is not unlikely. He provided a vivid instance of that intuition broadly shared by religions, and at times even by the religious, that human beings are sacred by nature. In this case, as in many others, human sanctity is taken to imply basic human equality, or at least a basic right to fairness and respect. Wycliffe wrote his thoughts on social conditions in language that could be understood by those who suffered under them. And he was furious. He said, "Lords should know God's law and study and maintain it, and destroy wrong and maintain poor men in their right to live in rest, peace, and charity, and suffer no men under their authority to do extortions, beat men, and hold poor men out of right by strength of lordships. Instead, lords, prelates, and rich men waste in pride and gluttony the treasure of poor men, the while they be in much pain and wretchedness in body and soul, that they despise poor men, and sometime beat them when they ask their pay, and thus lords devour poor men's goods in gluttony and waste and pride, and they perish for hardship and hunger and thirst and cold, and their children also, and if their rent be not readily paid, they are pursued without mercy, though they be never so poor and needy, and overcharged with age, feebleness, and loss of possessions, and with many children. These lords do not help a poor man to his right, but rather withhold poor men their hire, for which they have spent their flesh and their blood, and so in a manner they eat poor men's flesh and blood, and are man-killers. Wherefore God says by the prophet Isaiah that such lords are the fellows of thieves, and their hands are full of blood." Wycliffe's writings were seized and burned for more than 2 centuries, and yet I can read to you from a stout volume of his English works. His tradition was never successfully suppressed. In 1523, when Martin Luther's writings had begun to appear in England, Bishop Cuthbert Turnstall wrote to Erasmus that "it is no question of pernicious novelty. It is only that new arms are being added to the great band of Wycliffeite heretics." The similarity is more than coincidence, since Wycliffe's Latin writings circulated widely in Europe. If Lollardy was indeed a part of the identity and memory the Puritans brought with them to America, the evidence is clearest in the nature of their spirituality. Lollard said, "Lord, our belief is that thine house is man's soul." Another piece of evidence is again a difference between colonial Massachusetts and the colonial South. Even after the Restoration, London seems to have had relatively little interest in New England. The South was another matter. King Charles II commissioned John Locke, of all people, to produce a document called the Fundamental Constitutions of Carolina, at the time a general name for the South. "Out of his grace and bounty, the king granted these laws so that we may avoid erecting a numerous democracy." Presumably, this is a comment on the recently ended Commonwealth period, or New England, or both. This constitution is meant to erect instead a land-based aristocracy, descending ranks of narrowing privilege, a hereditary nobility owning by inheritance land they cannot divide among heirs or otherwise alienate, so that the ranks and orders will remain as they are forever. These ranks have fanciful names: the Palatine, beneath him Landgraves from the German, beneath him Caziques from the Haitian. Baronies figure somehow. Seldom mentioned are the leetmen, but conclusions can be drawn. Item 22 specifies that leetmen are subject to their particular lord without appeal. "Nor shall any leetman or leetwoman have liberty to go off from the land of their particular lord and live anywhere else without license obtained from their said lord under hand and seal." Here is item 23. "All the children of leetmen shall be leetmen, and so to all generations." This model was not realized, but the fact that the royal government would have been supportive of a colonial neo-feudalism through all the years that passed between Charles II and George III, from 1669 to 1775, can be assumed to have had an effect. In light of this, the distinctiveness, indeed the radicalism, of the Massachusetts codes and social order can be seen as highly intentional. Item 110 of the Fundamental Constitutions of Carolina says, "Every free man of Carolina shall have absolute power and authority over his Negro slaves, of what opinion or religion soever." In other words, Christian or not. The Laws and Liberties of Massachusetts says, "There shall never be any bond slavery, villainage, or captivity amongst us, unless it be lawful captives taken in just wars, or people who are indentured." These are regrettable exceptions, but the code specifies that these shall have all the liberties and Christian usages which the law of God established in Israel concerning such persons doth morally require. Again, we see the liberalizing influence of Moses. With all respect to the great Southerners who contributed so much wisdom and eloquence to independent America, New England had already made a long experiment with, by the standards of the world at the time, liberty and equality. The impositions of the royal government being limited in their case, they were relatively free to honor the old Lollard passion for ordinary people, first of all, as any good Wycliffeites would do, by providing for their education. When John Eliot made his translation of the Bible into the Algonquin language, published in 1663, he was attempting to do what Wycliffe did when he put it into English. I have not addressed every accusation made against the Puritans. Many have no basis in fact, or they fail to take into account English and European standards of the time, which very often make their severities seem mild. And the polemic against the Puritans has simply been done to death, a cultural tic that is mindless yet full of consequence because it leaves us without any sense of the origins of elements of our culture that we should be aware of so that they can be valued and perpetuated, and so that the impetus behind them can be understood. It is true that the laws passed in the Southern colonial assemblies, when they were allowed to meet, were more rational and humane than those imposed on them from London. Still, they are no model for a free society. We need to give the Puritans their due. New England was a long moment, an accident of history. The earliest immigrants meant to land in Virginia. If they had succeeded, no doubt many things would have been different, for them and for us. That some of them did make it through the first winter and the disasters that followed seems again almost accidental, but they did, and they became a small but growing society. They were very strongly shaped by events, past and present, on the other side of the ocean, the 30 Years' War, and then the English Civil Wars, and the Commonwealth and its collapse, which brought a flood of refugees of just the kind to reinforce an identity already formed. This is a singular history. If New England in the 19th century did not rise to what we considered just a few months ago to be civilized standards in its response to immigration, it is fair to consider the standards of those times and our own vulnerability to the appeal of nativism, for which, as an exercise in honesty, we should shoulder the blame ourselves. In any case, the influx of people with very different histories, together with the pull of the opening continent, brought the Puritan moment to an end. This does not mean that its influence has ended. There is still some point in speaking about this country in terms of its Puritan origins. They originated an understanding of law that made it a system of liberties rather than of prohibitions. They educated one another and themselves fervently, and wrote and printed with a passion to be expected of people whose ancestors might once have been accused of heresy for knowing the Ten Commandments. We still educate very broadly, though we seem to be forgetting where this impulse came from, that it was at its source a sharing out of the riches of civilization, prompted by that old belief that the mind was meant to be God's dwelling place. Education was, and I would say it still is, by far the most generous approach that can be made to the mysteries of mind, self, and soul, all of which know themselves as they create themselves. I approach tautology here, but this seems to be in the nature of the subject. Recently, I wrote an essay on Jonathan Edwards's treatise concerning religious affections. That is, on the inward experience of religion. I was struck by how suspicious he was of these affections, how prone the religious were, in his opinion and no doubt in his own experience as well, to self-deception, arrogance, and hypocrisy. By itself, this treatise might read as profound alienation from or disillusionment with his tradition and community. But Edwards provides lengthy footnotes, which cite great Puritan writers of the previous century, most of them English. They and he take the same view of the matter. The discipline of the mind to avoid presumption or any other abuse of the capacity to enjoy the knowledge of God is a great subject among them, before, during, and after their revolution. So far from expressing alienation, Edwards was invoking classic Puritanism and also carrying the tradition forward. No doubt his cautionary severity was called up by the passions of the Great Awakening, but he had major authorities ready to hand to second him in his warnings, which address tendencies in the human mind toward self-deception, hypocrisy, and the rest. It would be a crude reading of all this to assume that Puritans must have been more inclined to these faults than the generality of Christians. Since they were for them a primary sin and a cause of sins, they may have managed to be a little less guilty of them than others. In any case, this is an important consequence of their exaltation of the mind and its processes, which had to be used well and scrupulously. This is not a teaching of popular religion now. It has become commonplace to see those who pose as moralists and as exemplary Christians exposed in some particularly squalid act or practice, and to see them driven back, not by conscience, but by exposure, upon the mercy of Jesus, who, it would seem, died to neutralize the consequences of scurrilous behavior. So far as their co-religionists are concerned, they demonstrate the benefits of having been saved, which include using Christ as a strategy of concealment in the first place, with that great mercy always up their sleeves, in case things sometimes get embarrassing. Edwards says this about a style of piety flourishing among us now. As the love and joy of hypocrites are all from the source of self-love, so it is with their other affections, their sorrow for sin, their humiliation and submission, their religious desires and zeal. Everything is as it were paid for beforehand, and God's highly gratifying their self-love and their lusts by making so much of them and exalting them so highly as things are in their imagination. 'Tis easy for nature, as corrupt as it is, under a notion of being already some of the highest favorites of heaven, and having a God who does so protect 'em and favor 'em in their sins, to love this imaginary God that suits 'em so well, and to extol him, and submit to him, and to be fierce and zealous for him. Far better to have a lively fear of hypocrisy, granting that it is a subtle adversary, an endless temptation, as all those old divines agree, and given the fact that Jesus himself denounced it. From Wycliffe forward, the dignity of the individual was assumed to involve his or her being capable of responsibility for his or her thought and understanding, which meant a serious familiarity with the Bible and the kind of self-awareness the powerful pious in his time and others so utterly lacked. Faith is as close to and different from presumption as virtue is close to and different from hypocrisy. These subtleties fascinated the New Englanders, who seem never to have doubted that they were an issue for any mind in any moment. It has been usual to treat the great school of writers who emerged from American Puritan culture in the 19th century as having put aside the constraints of the old faith and stepped into a larger conceptual world. But in fact, the striking kinship among them suggests they found source and stimulus nearer home. Whatever else might be part of a Puritan worldview, the exalted mind is central for them, as it is for all these writers. Emerson, Thoreau, Whitman, Melville, Dickinson share a fascination with the commonest elements of life as they are mediated and entertained by perception and reflection. The Puritans spoke of their religion as experimental, that is, experiential. Sacredness is realized in the act of attention because reality is communicative, and the mind is made, grace assisting exquisite effort, to experience its meaning. Dickinson and Melville propose minds brilliantly critical of their own perceptions, opening a vastness of suggestion in every shortfall, like a Puritan sermon. Emerson, Thoreau, and Whitman see through all convenient or dismissive categories to the actual, the vital, and essential. In every case, their protagonist is the perceiver. The beauty they achieve has the character of acuity rather than refinement. It equalizes. The absence of shrines and rituals and processions that interpreted the world and guided understanding of it in England and Europe reflected, as absence, a sense of immanence that gave theological meaning to anything in itself in the moment of perception. A buzzing fly, a blade of grass. The exalted mind could understand the ordinary as visionary, given discipline and desire. The 17th century English Puritan John Flavel wrote in A Treatise of the Soul of Man that the soul of the poorest child is of equal dignity with the soul of Adam. He said this about a human being: "It is a most astonishing mystery to see heaven and earth married together in one person, the dust of the ground and an immortal spirit clasping each other with such dear embraces and tender love, such a noble and divine guest to take up its residence within the mean walls of flesh and blood. Alas, how little affinity, and yet what dear affection is found betwixt them, while breath sweetly links them." Whitman's addresses to his soul might have had thoughts like this behind them. Whitman and any of his contemporaries might have read Flavel. He, or someone of similar mind, might well have come up in a sermon. Perhaps we have given ourselves lives and expectations that are too small to sustain the customs and institutions the Puritans left to us. Or perhaps we will recover languages that can acknowledge the great mystery and dignity of humankind, which is essential to the best they left us. Here, at Harvard Divinity School, is the perfect place for such work to be done. Slander. Trinity Cathedral, Little Rock, Arkansas, February 25, 2017. My mother lived to be 92. She spent her last decades, her widowhood, in a condominium in a retirement community near my brother and his family in Charlottesville, Virginia. She had lived a very private, sheltered, small-town life, never employed, devoted to her flowers and her dogs. She was a sharp-minded woman, aware and proud of her intelligence to the end of her life. She was complicated, and my relationship with her was never easy, but it was interesting, which was probably better for me, all in all. With a little difficulty, we finally reached an accommodation, an adult friendship. Then she started watching Fox News. She had a circle of friends who watched Fox News, then gathered to share that peculiar salacious dread over coffee cake. My mother would call to ask me if I thought the world was coming to an end, which put me at something of a loss. I would tell her that, according to Jesus, we would not know the day or the hour, but she would always have just been updated by one of those commentators she and her circle called by their first names, as if they were trusted friends. The authority of Jesus was not quite robust in the light of breaking news. Sharia law, a war against Christmas. Who, she would say, would attack Christmas? Just about nobody, of course. But the point of her question was not to doubt that the plot was afoot, but to isolate these imagined malefactors from the human and American norm. These instances may sound absurd, but they are real, and like many things of their kind, they estranged and alienated a significant part of the population from those dark forces, I must include myself here, who would and could, for example, put a radical Kenyan Muslim in the White House. I know I risk raising doubts about my mother's soundness of mind when I say that she was deeply persuaded of the truth of what she heard from Sean and Megan and Bill. But she was at least as acute as any of the millions who watched with her and learned to share the same view of the world and, crucially, of the country. Toward the end of her life, my mother began to be tormented by anxieties and regrets. I, her daughter, a self-professed liberal, was one of those who had ruined America. I would go to hell for it, too, a fact she considered both regrettable and just. She did shoulder some blame. She should have been far stricter than she was all those years ago, when my character was still forming. A mother less fox-saturated might have taken satisfaction from degrees and prizes, but to her, they were proof that I was in league with the sinister other. They were enhancements of a prominence I could only misuse. My mother lived out the end of her fortunate life in a state of bitterness and panic, never having had the slightest brush with any experience that would confirm her in these emotions, except, of course, Fox News. She went to her rest before she would have had to deal with the ignominy of my conversation with the president. I saw a clip of some Fox blondie saying that our conversation proved that Obama hated Christianity. Those who have read my books might think me an odd choice of interlocutor if that were the case, but having struggled in the tangled web of my mother's reasoning, I know that the impassioned little commentator might actually have found a way to believe what she said. If not, the polarization she was at that moment exploiting and making worse meant there was precious little chance her listeners would pick up a copy of the New York Review of Books to read the conversation for themselves. One mother, one life to live by, which she would judge the fruitfulness of her own life, one twilight in which human mortality becomes at the same time mythic and real. I wish it could have been better for both of us. What a weird intrusion, these loud voices shouting down memory and reflection and assurance, nullifying the most intimate kinship. My mother loved this country and was deeply persuaded that it was in peril. First of all, in having tempted the wrath of God with all its liberalism. Again, this was not dementia. She and her friends were actually or virtually housebound. If they had kept their eyesight and their driver's licenses, I have no doubt that some of them would have been out shopping for guns, as so many of the young and strong were doing at the same time for the same reasons. This is, of course, the age of the weird intrusion. We have voices in our heads that can neutralize experience and displace the world we observe with a much more urgent and dramatic reality, a reality with a plot line and strongly identified characters, with villains bent on enormity and all that is sacred in desperate need of rescue. For my mother and her friends, this was excitement, a big dose of adrenaline, and its appeal in their circumstances is understandable, at least by comparison with its attraction for people who are healthy and mobile and who still enjoy some exposure to the world and some control over their lives. I remember when I was a child, walking out of a movie theater and finding the world outside utterly bland and dull. Now we can all impose technicolor fantasies on that world, if we are so inclined. Infotainment, they call it. The text for today is from the Epistle of James, chapter 3, verses 5 through 10. How great a forest is set ablaze by a small fire, and the tongue is a fire. The tongue is placed among our members as a world of iniquity. It stains the whole body, sets on fire the cycle of nature, and is itself set on fire by hell. For every species of beast and bird, of reptile and sea creature, can be tamed, and has been tamed by the human species. But no one can tame the tongue, a restless evil, full of deadly poison. With it we bless the Lord and Father, and with it we curse those who are made in the likeness of God. From the same mouth come blessing and cursing. My brothers and sisters, this ought not to be so. This is very strong language indeed, cautioning against a sin we seldom hear mentioned, and perhaps have no ready name for. James is not speaking of the lies we tell, although they would certainly fall within his condemnation, since to speak the truth is certainly to tame the tongue in some respects, depending on circumstances. He represents speech as literally inflammatory, as it can be when even what is said is possibly or arguably true, or in fact true. Think of the role of informants and spies who have shaped history in often grievous ways by saying something true. Judas kissed Jesus in Gethsemane. The gesture is false because it is not an expression of love or respect, and it is true because it singles out the man Judas has promised to betray to the authorities. We all know people who speak damaging truth, often by violating confidences or by acting on an indifference to tact or kindness. James was clearly concerned with more than lying, more even than slander. He is categorical in his denunciation. The tongue is a world of iniquity, a restless evil, full of deadly poison. He offers no rule for the control of it, except that we remember that other human beings are made in the likeness of God and are owed the kind of respect he is owed. John Flavel, a 17th-century English Puritan, considers the thought that we might all be judged twice, once when we die, and again when the full consequences of our lives have played themselves out. I find myself turning to this idea often. He says this will not have occurred until no living mind remembers any slander, any injurious word that we have spoken. He was writing in the early days of mass literacy in print, so he would have meant the memory and effect of spoken words. No need for a pulpit or a soapbox now. Any one of us can bully and slander at will. So, in light of history, perhaps we should consider his suggestion very carefully. James says the power of the tongue is utterly disproportionate to the human person, like a bit to a horse or a rudder to a ship. This is truer in an infinite degree now that we have the means to multiply and perpetuate whatever proceeds from it endlessly. Someone must have been the first to say that Jews poison wells and cause plague. Certain strata of Christendom saw advantage in focusing hostility on the Jews, which became catastrophic when these libels spread. The tongue made women into witches, dissenters into heretics, and for centuries horror swept the world. The tongue called for lynchings. We know that Christians suffered under the same mass aversion in the early days of the faith, that they were stigmatized with rumors of atheism and cannibalism, and were persecuted on these grounds. But James is clearly speaking more generally. These conflagrations are not isolated phenomena. They are a pervasive consequence of the misuse of the human power of language. They are not the fault of others who defame the Christian community, but potentially and actually their fault, our fault, whenever we speak without respect for the image of God, which is the only form in which a human being can ever present herself to us. I keep returning in my mind to Flavel's proposal that we might face two judgments. Let us say that God is atemporal and omniscient. Let us say he is attentive to the words of our mouths and the meditations of our hearts. Then he can only be aware of the human context of a thought, the future history of a word. If some resentment or rage is building in a population, any of us might well share in it, justifying it to ourselves on the basis of the very consensus that will make it destructive, even lethal. That the same malice can simmer in 100,000 minds might lead us to believe that it must surely be based in something rational, that it is not simply another instance of the potential of ungoverned thought and language to breed firestorms. Surely we are beyond witch hunts and Jew baiting and their like. Surely. People enjoy sharing in consensus, especially when it allows us to indulge a guilty pleasure, to be among the despisers rather than the despised, to feel we have permission to express, if only to ourselves, hostilities we might otherwise find shameful. Catharsis can feel so good, and so can the strong sense of identity that comes with knowing who is with you and who is against you, whether this is true or not. The drama depends on your believing you have antagonists, even if a bit of invention is required to make them in any way sinister. But if our words and meditations are present to God's sight, as we so often say they are, and if for him 1,000 years are like a day, he might see in any of our thoughts and utterances the impulse that in a year, a decade, or a century will disrupt peace and destroy life. From his perspective, it could be a word spoken by anyone, an acquiescence in some ordinary meanness, that tips a nation toward offense, disgrace, brutality. In other words, we might at any moment, at every moment, stand before God as in that second judgment, guilty for our part in crimes we do not quite intend and will not live to see. I am increasingly persuaded that we Christians need to expand our moral universe and to find a way of thinking and speaking that allows us to acknowledge the complexity of a morality deserving the name. I hear people talk of accepting Christ as their personal savior. This is the threshold of salvation by their lights, the narrow gate. But who is Christ? According to the Gospel of John, he was present at the creation and central to it. Without him, nothing was made that was made. I keep Greek images of Christ Pantocrator, a great figure of triumph and power, to correct for what seems to me a diminished sense of Jesus in Western religion. A diminished Christ is not Christ, just as a diminished God is not God. To put another object of worship in their place is idolatry. Lately, I have heard more frequently persons who consider themselves religious conservatives saying that those who are redeemed need not take their sins or the sins of the redeemed in general or their allies too seriously. So great was the suffering of Christ, so precious his blood, so loving his nature, so profound his humbling, that they can be up to things he specifically condemns, things that expose his name on earth to ridicule and contempt. And it will not matter at all from their point of view, which is to say, insofar as their personal salvation is concerned. I would propose that this view of things turns on a faulty definition of sin. In the great majority of cases, a sin is injury done to another person, other people, whom, we must assume, God loves at least as much as he loves us. The loving kindness Jesus models for us is very largely a matter of feeding and healing those in need of such care. The sins denounced by the prophets, or if you prefer, by God through the prophets, are sins that create poverty and exploit and abuse the poor. Thou shalt not kill, steal, bear false witness. John Calvin says it is theft to fail to show anyone the honor due him, always implying James's standard, the honor due the image of God. This standard was of great interest to the 14th century, and again to the Reformation, but I haven't seen much attention paid to it in the last few centuries. A great lapse, a great loss. In any case, Jesus makes it clear that he is one among the hungry, the thirsty, the naked, the imprisoned, which is very much to the same point. In the grandeur of his triumph, he is also judge of the quick and the dead. We are never given to believe that he will overlook the scorn and injury done to the vulnerable. After all, in order to identify himself with them, he parted the heavens and became a slave obedient unto death. Those who feel they have crossed a line into assured salvation look back on the rest of us as essentially deficient in the things the Lord requires, not lacking in justice and mercy, perhaps, but lacking in that special assurance that makes justice and mercy optional, and humility a possible sign of weak faith. It is necessary, by the lights of this theology, that one believe in his or her redeemed condition, whether it follows from a conversion experience of some kind, or is maintained through the doctrines and sacraments of a church. By extension, they must also believe that those who have the same theory and narrative of redemption are also saved. So they become, in effect, a faction whose loyalty is to itself, without ethical conditions, putting aside or radically devaluing the standards of Christian life, which can be seen by them as distracting from the free and sufficient act of God's salvation. And so we have scandals in the church, and we have the collapse of standards in regard to public figures and organizations who are seen to advance the interests of this faction. Therefore, the great gift of their Christianism to the country is the disruption and loss of a moral orientation that for cultural and historical reasons has always been Christian. Putting aside for the moment the subject of truth, of how the word truth is to be understood, there is the issue I mentioned earlier, that is, the way we speak of and to one another, and the consequences that follow from the words we speak, as well as from the kind of speech we give our attention to. In Matthew chapter 12, verses 36 to 37, Jesus says, I tell you, on the day of judgment, you will have to give an account for every careless word you utter, for by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned. This seems to me to imply that one's spiritual state remains an open question until the end of life, so far as we can be aware. Be that as it may. It is interesting to note that the religious right and the dystopian news outlets arose together. I speculate that this Christianism I have spoken of needed proof of a radical qualitative difference between itself and society at large. So, secularism bestrides the land like Gog and Magog, and Christians are treated with contempt and hostility. None of this is true, but it is a cherished belief that allows comfortable people to reckon themselves among the martyrs. This need to see unredeemed America as a netherworld has been served by tales of flaming inner cities and raging crime rates. The difference between reality according to Walter Cronkite and reality according to Glenn Beck is to be seen as a measure of decline in the culture, not as a recent exploitation of a burgeoning market for bleak and angry sensationalism. Again, the fact that these outlets are themselves vulgar and bent on inflicting injury is not a problem, since by these means they fuel the excitements of the religious right. This certainly ought not to be considered a benefit to them as Christians, but it does indeed consolidate them as a faction. Of course, Christianity has never been innocent of this sort of thing. I grant that claims to traditionalism going back to antiquity can be made by those prone to unhealthy collective excitements. I am about to write a series of lectures on the Old Testament, a text with which Christian interpretation has always struggled mightily. My impulse tends to be to find my way back to an early stage in the development of an issue, since the trajectory it will follow is often established then. I have just read St. John Chrysostom's Homilies on the Obscurity of the Old Testament. Chrysostom means golden-mouthed, a sobriquet given to him because of the famous eloquence of his preaching. He was the bishop of Constantinople, a prolific contemporary of St. Augustine and St. Jerome, a figure of great importance to the subsequent development of the Church. To explain the obscurity, from the point of view of Christian readers, of the Hebrew Bible, he mentions the problems that always arise in translation, the difficulty of approaching any experience that is new to one, and so on. But the explanation he dwells on and elaborates is of another kind altogether. The Hebrew Scriptures, he says, are obscure because God did not want the Jews to understand them. Their prophets were actually writing for and in anticipation of Christians. He says, they, the prophets, forecast many troubles for Jews, as well as the fact that, whereas they will be rejected, we will be given a place, and the fact that the temple will be destroyed to rise no more, while Jerusalem will fall and be trampled on by all. And, if they, the Jews, heard this from the inspired authors unmistakably, they would immediately have killed those telling them this, being frenzied and savage, bloodthirsty people. He says, they would also have burnt the inspired books themselves if they understood their contents. He may not have invented the use of anti-Semitism as a hermeneutical tool, but he has certainly provided an explicit early instance of it. If his words have influenced subsequent interpretation, this is surely not their final, gravest consequence. In any case, this virus sleeps in the cells of even very modern biblical scholarship. Irony of ironies, Chrysostom turns from this diatribe against the Jews to an exhortation against speaking ill of people. There could hardly be a more terrible instance of the power of the evil he condemns than the impact of his own words on the subsequent history of Jews and Christendom. Do we hear comparable slanders now? I suppose that depends on whether or not we believe Hillary Clinton might actually have been running a child prostitution ring from a pizza parlor. There seems to be very little limit to how bizarre or scurrilous these rumors can be, and yet survive and multiply. As I have said, there are those who devoutly wish the worst to be true. So rumors have a medium conducive to their growth. When Chrysostom was wise, he was very wise indeed, and his comments on evil or merely ill-considered speech are very relevant to our own historical moment. Again, he is speaking to Christians, now in terms of their obligations as Christians, which include that rather neglected virtue, self-restraint. He says, just as if we opened the tombs, we would fill the cities with pestilence. So, if we had no qualms about opening vile mouths, we would fill all our associates with a worse disease. Hence the necessity of placing a door, a bar, and a curb on our mouth. And, let us teach the need to keep a curb on our tongue, and not simply to give vent to everything that comes to mind, not to criticize the brethren, not to bite and devour one another. People who do this in words are worse than those biting the body. The latter bite the body with their teeth, the former bite the soul with their words. They wound reputations, they leave an incurable injury. And, instead of bruiting abroad others' vices, let us cloak them over. Let us not bite and chew each other's wounds. This is a ghastly metaphor, worse than the others he offers, of vile talk as flies that land on wound after wound, carrying infection everywhere. Then again, this present time, when we find ourselves struggling to maintain our civic life because of our loss of the ethos of restraint, civility, and truthfulness, could lead us to consequences we cannot yet foresee, when his metaphors will seem entirely apt. We know this can happen. It may be the case that Chrysostom's prohibitions against vile language pertain especially to the brethren, fellow Christians. Perhaps it is they who are to be spared these attacks. Certainly they seem always have needed to have such restraint preached to them. Paul tells the church at Galatia, "The whole law is summed up in a single commandment, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. If, however, you bite and devour one another, take care that you are not consumed by one another." To the Ephesians he says, "Let no evil talk come out of your mouths, but only what is useful for building up, as there is need, so that your words may give grace to those who hear. Put away from you all bitterness and wrath and anger and wrangling and slander, together with all malice, and be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, as God in Christ has forgiven you." We in this Christian country are consuming one another now, bringing disgrace to the faith with our internecine ferocities, then alarmed that the church's numbers dwindle. A thing that does tend to be forgotten in all this is that Clinton is a Methodist, Obama is a member of the United Church of Christ, as am I. Even if these protections Chrysostom calls for are narrower than we might wish, they should at least be broad enough to shelter the three of us. If Clinton were as notoriously corrupt as, I struggle and fail to think of a notoriously corrupt Methodist, on what grounds is she excluded from the flock? Just the same might be asked about Obama. Chrysostom says of Paul that when he sees others also passing judgment on other people's vices, he warns them, "Do not judge before the time, before the Lord comes, who will bring to light the hidden things of darkness and disclose the intentions of the heart." If it is wrong to judge actual vices, how much worse must it be to condemn others for invented vices, concocted for no other reason than to slander and wound them? There are other inducements now, too. Ratings, politics, the gratification of an audience that wants to hear the worst, then perhaps share it over coffee cake. Perhaps a new vocabulary is needed for new variants of old sins. Perhaps not. These days, people can be heard wondering how we have come to this place of rancor and division, and how we can move beyond it. To effect change in a culture so vast and complex as this one would seem imponderably difficult. But there are a good many Christians among us, even if only the faction who consider themselves an embattled minority can claim to qualify. They, and all the rest of us who accept the authority of Scripture, can find many passages that describe the Christian life, which is, as it says in Titus chapter 3, verse 2, to speak evil of no one, to avoid quarreling, to be gentle, and to show every courtesy to everyone. In Galatians, on the one hand, Paul says, "The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, generosity, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control." And on the other hand, in the first chapter of Romans, he lists the sins of the worst pagans. Among other things, they were filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, covetousness, malice. Full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, craftiness, they are gossips, slanderers, God-haters. The list is long. I quote from it to make the point that malicious speech ranks among the gravest transgressions. In the third chapter, again describing sinfulness, Paul quotes from Psalms and Isaiah, "There is no one who shows kindness, not even one." And, "Their throats are open graves, they use their tongues to deceive." And, The venom of vipers is under their lips, and their tongues are full of cursing and bitterness. He tells the Colossians that as Christians they must give up old sins. You must get rid of all such things, anger, wrath, malice, slander, and abusive language from your mouth. To Timothy, he says, avoid profane chatter, for it will lead people into more and more impiety, and their talk will spread like gangrene. Peter says, rid yourself of all malice and all guile, insincerity, envy, and all slander. Damaging speech, the use of words to do harm, is clearly both a mark of sinfulness and a major sin in its own right. Other kinds of evil actions proceed from it. So Scripture tells us, so history tells us. In the ordinary course of life, we can evaluate what we hear and apply standards of plausibility. People who seem to respect the norms of courtesy and rectitude and abide by them are probably not up to anything too outlandish, so we give them the benefit of the doubt, unless we nurse a discreditable motive of our own for wanting to see them taken down a peg. Only if some kind of evidence emerges, or if we see something with our own eyes, are we inclined to consider a slander to reflect more discredit on the person who is its object than on the bearer of opprobrium. Gossips are a type, often resentful, generally looking to establish a bond of friendship or intimacy at the expense of someone's privacy or reputation. If we choose to tolerate them, it is often because we can't avoid them, but we know who they are, and this is another means we have of appraising what they say. But when the objects of slander are not individuals, but groups, so that the departure of the generous, upright, intelligent individuals one actually knows from the characterizations that damn the group as a whole are to the credit of those individuals only, and can be excluded from evidence that the characterization of the group is false, then people lose the stabilizing tendency to consult experience in order to establish the limits of probability. And when no source can be identified for whispers and slurs, so that the source seems to be or is a consensus among a population with which one identifies, they are granted plausibility on these grounds. Historically, one great consequence of all this is what we now call polarization, by no means a new phenomenon. Jews were ghettoized, African Americans were ghettoized, and increasingly most of us isolate ourselves, mutually in our case, as affinity groups or perhaps aversion groups, the division between us based not so much on origins or race or even faith as on our sources of information or what we credit as information. Even when we are not isolated from one another, as for example urban and rural, even when at holidays we have dinner around the same table, many of us can no longer simply talk politics without igniting a battle of conflicting certitudes. A substrate of all this is religion. So at least many people say and believe. I acknowledge passion on the side that identifies itself as religious, but neither this passion nor the worldview that sustains it resembles religion as I understand the word. In any case, people who feel they are defending religion by looking at the world the way they do cannot, on principle, accept the legitimacy of another view of it. My teaching and writing have given me an unusual perspective on all this. When I applied for a faculty position at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, the job description said that candidates should be able to teach the Bible as literature. People always seem to be surprised to hear this. I suppose writers are assumed to be raffish sorts with self-destructive habits and an ironic indifference to the sacred in all its forms. This notion must have set in at about the time that French painters became forever associated with berets and waxed mustaches. In my experience, writers are estimable people with an extraordinarily broad range of interests and sympathies. It is appropriate to teach scripture in programs like ours, because the Bible is so important to our literature that young writers are usually interested in it, if only because it helps them to understand earlier writers they admire. Many of them were uncomfortable at being seen carrying a Bible on campus, because the groups who have been so successful at claiming Christianity as their own exclusive province have also been successful in associating it with intolerance, guns, and hostility to science, among other things. In the present environment, Christianity is not scorned or rejected because it is the gospel of faith, hope, and love, but because this Christianity of theirs, on whatever pretext, is determined to bring bad news to the poor and the stranger, and is even self-righteous about this. People who claim to care for the future of Christianity should listen to their critics rather than falling back on resentment.